now on bookmark, The Rights of My People. Louis Kalani's enduring battle with the United States, 1893 to 1917. Neil Thomas Photo is with us for the bookmark program. Neil, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it today.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
You know, I never think about, and probably wrongly so, think about Native Hawaiians as part of the struggle for their property. We always think of Native Americans, but about Hawaiians. Is it the same thing?
Well, in some respects it is, but you would lose a lot of history if you just make the analogy too strongly. For Native Hawaiians, they occupied and controlled a nation, 8 Hawaiian islands, and had been in existence for 100-plus years. And it wasn't until 1893 that the United States Navy came in to support an attempt to take over the island by a small group of men who were largely the children of the missionaries who had occupied Hawaii in the 1820s. And when that takeover occurred, and this is important, Hawaii was a constitutional monarchy. That is, it had a popularly elected legislature. It had a judicial system that was quite active and well-organized, and a large executive branch. So that it had all the elements of a democratic country in terms of principles and conduct that we recognize then and today as being valuable and important. So in that sense, it was different historically than what we confronted when we occupied lands that had been controlled by Native Americans.
Well, so from what I understand, this is not as many people thought, that Hawaii was ceded to the United States from Spain as a loss of the Spanish-American War.
No, it was not. It was actually taken and annexed. The annexation, it was taken long before that, this 1893 takeover that's supported by the United States. And it wasn't until much later that the Spanish-American War occurred and the Philippines were involved in this conflict with the United States. And then when the annexation occurred in 1898, that was around the time of the war with the Philippines.
Is it part of the considered manifest destiny?
Well, actually, no, it's more problematic than that. One of the most interesting things that I focus on in this book is that by 1893, when Hawaii basically comes to the attention of the United States, here in Washington, D.C., which is where I am, the members of Congress who are in control of the important committees of Congress are Southerners. And they are Southerners who fought in the Civil War on the side of the Confederacy. And you get an attitude about race and culture that really pervades the view of Hawaii and the importance for Southerners and for the South to regain, in effect, their own independence from the North, and they see trade and the occupation of Hawaii as a way of doing that.
Now, you also talk about the Queen comes to the United States to make her case. When does that happen?
Well, between 1898 and 1910, Louis O'Kalani visits the United States 7 times. So this is after annexation. And when she comes, she had come once during annexation, but when she starts to come after that, her goal is to regain 1 million acres of land that had been taken from her, and that land had been used for the benefit of poor Native Hawaiians. It had been taken by the United States.
Okay.
So she's in the United States really to argue that claim before Congress and the President, and then ultimately files a lawsuit against the United States called Louis O'Kalani versus the United States of America. She files it in the United States Court of Claims, which incidentally is almost right across the street from the White House. It still exists.
Now, is anybody paying attention to her? Does anybody give it the time of day?
Well, actually, yes, they do. She gets a lot of serious consideration from a number of people, but in the end, the forces of both the racial issues, the fact that they're dark skinned, the contention that they were culturally different, really were the forces that, and that there was a lot of land involved. And the United States was intent on getting it. She's not able to prevail here in Washington, D.C. But what she does succeed in doing is she dramatically demonstrates, one, that she is a woman of great integrity and dignity. And she was an author, she was a poet, wrote music, and she was a quite dignified woman in terms of her presence and her ability to articulate her view. Very fluent in English as well as, of course, Hawaiian, and a great writer. She really changes the image of the Native Hawaiian community during that time and who she is. And she was the one who ultimately shows that in the end, Hawaiians are not going to be happy. They will not be content. There will be a continuing resentment unless this issue was handled properly, and it was not.
But is that why that there seems to be resentment even today?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is. And, Mark, the resentment today goes really back to 1893 and 1898. There was never a vote or a referendum in Hawaii about whether they wanted to be annexed to the United States. And the fact that this 50th anniversary of Hawaii statehood occurred just this past year, just a few months ago, there were no commemoration of it in the state of Hawaii, is for that reason, because of this lingering resentment and sadness and disappointment in terms of what occurred back then.
Can you fast forward for our listeners to the statehood question? Who drives the question from Hawaii? Is it Washington trying to pull them in because they see all the natural resources? Or is it really a movement that people say, you know what, we survived World War II and the attack here, we really need to be further under the umbrella of the United States? What's happening?
Well, I think that's a very important question and a good question. I think for the Native Hawaiian community, what they were troubled by in 1959 when the statehood question arose for the first time, or when it really began to crystallize, was that there was not a vote about independence. In other words, they didn't get to make that vote. But I think there was a recognition among a good many people in Hawaii that it was appropriate to come under this umbrella. We were really still close to Pearl Harbor had happened. We were in the Cold War. And there were forms of prosperity that a lot of people then welcomed. But none of that, as it turns out, eliminated or diminished this underlying resentment and this sadness and disappointment over what had occurred in terms of the way their nation was actually taken from them. And how somehow to resolve that, you see, have to find some means by which the United States and the people of Hawaii could work out some kind of reconciliation of that underlying resentment.
How did they treat, let's go back to the Queen, how was she treated when she came over to this country? Was she treated like any other head of state, or is it a real fuzzy area?
Well, I think it was a fuzzy area in some ways, but she got, when she came to the United States, she got instant notoriety. She spent a lot of time in San Francisco. The moment she got off the steamer from Hawaii, she was interviewed, including by the New York Times or Washington, D.C. papers or papers throughout the country. She then would make these long train trips across the country. These were in the days of having to do four or five solid days of travel to cross the United States to come to the Eastern Seaboard. And even in those times, she would be interviewed. She would be talked to. And very nicely treated for the most part. In other words, people were very respectful. Now, she had family in Boston. That is, her husband's family, her husband had died many years earlier, but her husband's family came from Boston. And so she was able to spend time there and was welcomed by many people in Boston. And then, of course, she spent most of her time in Washington, D.C., where she began to have in order to engage in this battle for the million acres of land that I described to you earlier. And she made some friends, actually a good many friends. And her real dilemma was that she could not convince the Congress of the United States, or the president, or eventually a court of law, that this 1 million acres of land had been taken away improperly and either should be restored or some form of compensation provided for it.
All right, let's look at the president. She's dealing with what? Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft?
Oh, yes, they were all Republican presidents. Yes, so both of them, William Henry Harrison, McKinley. And so it was during this time period that the United States was quite intent on looking outward, as it is, to nations basically to acquire and to be part of America, and so it was a Republican administration that she was dealing with.
And is she? Did they have an embassy? Did they have some place for her to call a base of operations during the many visits to Washington?
No, she did not. She came here throughout this time period. Actually, from 1893 on, throughout the entire fight over whether Hawaii should or should not be annexed, and throughout this time period through 1910, in these numerous visits to the United States, the Queen used her own money. She borrowed money. She sold property. She did everything she could to try to support this effort to regain first her nation and then this land. So when she was here, she was living in lives in hotels. She sometimes would rent homes, especially in Washington, D.C., and she was here for long periods of time, 6 to 8 months a year at times, for those seven visits that I described to you.
Right.
And again, met a lot of people, but it was all at her own expense.
Now, how does this situation get resolved? As one reads through this book, and we're talking with Neil Thomas Proto, the author of the book, The Rights of My People. Is the issue ever resolved to the satisfaction of people, or is it just it goes away, or does the issue just disappear upon statehood? What happens?
When she dies in 1917, she is still troubled, still uncomfortable, still disappointed, that especially not only has she lost the sovereignty of her nation, Native Hawaiians had, but also the loss of this 1 million acres of land. And so what lingers after that isn't a resolution. It is a disappointment. It's an anger. It's a resentment. And it's never really resolved, and it still has not been resolved. And it's one of the reasons, again, why there was no commemoration in Hawaii for the 50th anniversary of statehood that occurred just past year. It's this lingering feeling of disappointment and sadness and resentment.
Exit question. Do Hawaiians at the time of Queen Lalakalani liken their struggle to the American independence from the British?
Well, actually they did. They cited the Declaration of Independence. They were very committed. As I mentioned to you earlier, there was a constitutional form of government. They believed in the people voting. Hawaii was one of the most literate nations in the world in 1898, had a higher rate of literacy in English than America did at the time. They elected people popularly. They were very active, and they really analogized themselves and hoped that America would look upon them as America had looked at the British, which is this was a nation that wanted to preserve their independence, and they cited the Declaration of Independence in that regard.
Finally, do you write, I believe in this book, that there is a bill pending in Congress?
Well, I don't write about it in the book because the book really ends with the Queen's death in 1917. But there is a bill pending in Congress involving a form of recognition for both the wrongdoing that occurred, but more importantly, a form of recognition that would give the Native Hawaiian community in Hawaii a means or a mechanism by which they can start to regain perhaps some of this land, but also just something that recognizes the dignity and the integrity and the independence of who they are as a people. And that's currently pending in the House and the Senate of the United States.
Neil Thomas Proto, the book, The Rights of My People, our guest on the Bookmark program. Neil, fascinating story. Thanks so much for telling it to us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark.